call the House Committee on Healthcare to order and open a public hearing on House Bill 2074. And I'll call a paradox up to the me and Dr. Goldberg.
A paradox, huh?
I like that. Paradox.
Yeah. A paradox.
Two docs, right?
Oh, a paradox.
For the record, Bruce Goldberg, Director of the Oregon Health Authority. And just to clarify, because Dr. Greenleck always reminds me, he's a real doctor.
That's right. For the record, I'm State Representative Mitch Greenleck, House District 33, and I'm pleased to open the testimony on House Bill 2074. House Bill 2074 is a bill to streamline government, to make it more efficient and to deal with an agency that's had its share of problems, but to give it a home that's a more proper home. The main thing the bill does is move it from its ambiguous status now as a sort of independent agency to the auspices of the Oregon Health Authority, to allow, and in doing so, to change its name from the Oregon Health Licensing Agency to the Oregon Health Licensing Office. It's a simple change, but one that will put it in an administrative framework that we believe will enhance its efficiency. And we've talked to a variety of people, and it seems like a proper thing to do. And Dr. Goldberg.
Chair Greenleck and members of the committee, I was asked to comment about how this would work and whether or not this would be a difficult thing for the agency to do, whether it would cost dollars, et cetera. And I'm here today to let you know, first off, when we formed the Health Authority, we took actually several different agencies and were able to incorporate them as part of the Oregon Health Authority. That was done within existing resources and actually did help us, streamline and work more effectively. So we've got some experience doing that. Should it be the policy choice of the legislature for us to do this, we can certainly do this as well. In addition, we do some health licensing within the Oregon Health Authority and for a number of functions. And, you know, it's likely that what we would look to do would be to, you know, further streamline and look to put together a variety of health licensing functions within this office. And I think, quite frankly, where we would likely see more of the efficiency and effectiveness is on the part of a number of the health licensing functions that we do within the agency, being combined with what's done by the health licensing agency. Because from what I've seen, they have a good and an efficient process, and by putting all of this together, would help to streamline things.
Marcia, would you like to?
Hello. Chair Greenleck, Vice Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. My name is Holly Mercer. I'm the Interim Executive Director for the Oregon Health Licensing Agency. And we sent over some testimony today. I think that was mostly a piece of our budget presentation that's coming up next week. But I think it gives a great overview of this agency. It combines 11 boards that have a variety of functions and a variety of sizes and a variety of professions. We have a $6.6 million budget. We have 33 FTE and going up to 35, we hope, through this budget period. It is an agency that has brought in some boards that have been developing. We brought in, if you look on the listing, on the summary, We license and regulate athletic trainers, body art practitioners, cosmetologists, denture technology, direct entry midwives, environmental health registration participants, hearing aid counsel, licensed dietitians, nursing home administrators, respiratory therapists, and I'll try to say this correctly, polysomnographic technologists, and sex offender treatment board. And interestingly, some of these boards could be grouped together. We know that the licensed dietitians definitely have had a health history. When they came over to join us in 2011, it was after the Nursing Home Administrator Board joined us in 2008 and the Sex Offender Treatment Board joined us in 2007. We have a very flat organization. We have 33 FTE and three managers. That's excluding our HR analyst. So we feel we're quite efficient. We have a total of 29 board meetings each year. That's excluding all the committee meetings that we have in between. I feel that we have a very efficient method of doing this work. Spending the last 5 years at the Board of Nursing as their executive director, it has been a very interesting 3 months for me. I am quite new to this position, so I'm still on a learning curve, but I would be happy to answer any questions. We will be neutral on this bill. We will certainly work with the health authority if that's the policy decision to move us, and would look forward to working with them. Thank you.
We've ended up, this doesn't show a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, but the fiscal analysis, if you look at it, suggests that there needs to be budgetary work because they'll be moving sums of money from one reserve budgets into other budgets. So we will be, I hope, acting on it, sending it to Ways and Means for their action. Are there any questions of any of the three testifiers?
Question, Mr. Chair. Thank you. In addition to going from OLA to OLO, I guess you will call it from now on, I just wondered if you could say what effectively this will explain some of the changes. What will it mean? Does it mean Holly will be reporting to you, and what level of reporting over what kinds of issues? Like, what's the authority change? What does it effectively mean to have this happen?
Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, I think effectively what that would mean is that the oversight of the Health Licensing Office would be from the Director of the Oregon Health Authority. And how that would be structured and how that would work would be worked out between the office and the agency, but ultimately the point of responsibility is the director of the agency.
Yes, Chair Greenlick, Representative Kenny Geyer. This position currently reports to the Department of Administrative Services. Mm-hmm. So Michael Jordan is my direct supervisor. Mm-hmm. I believe then that would change to Dr. Goldberg. But also, from my understanding of the bill is that it does not change the structure of the boards in relationship to the health to our agency, in that the boards are still mostly advisory boards, mm-hmm. and final order authority and rulemaking authority stays with the director of the agency.
Mm-hmm. At least it's not intended to change any of those.
That's
correct. Who knows in the bill this
long?
But occasionally pops up. Yeah. Any other questions?
Thank you.
Holly, can I ask you a independent question?
Yes, sir.
There's been some concern about the use of Botox by people who aren't otherwise mm-hmm. authorized to use it. Is this something that's partly inside your agency as well as partly inside the medical board?
Yes. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, that actually is something that we're looking into. We are going to put a work group together to address some of the issues around Botox and also use of lasers, which does cross many boards and many healthcare boards, including boards within our purview. So we want to put that together after the session is over, and I'll be communicating with executive directors from nursing, from medical, dental, and pharmacy about those issues.
You know, we have raised the issue of the use of scalpel and scarifying and other kinds
yes,
of things.
Yes, sir, we have. Yes.
Your folks do, so
yes.
it's a very important issue in what's practicing medicine without a license and what's inside.
Mm-hmm.
That's very good. You might want to talk to the representative from Allergan, because they say an additional problem with Botox is that they're illegally importing Botox as well in some of those uses. So, good. Well, thank you both very much.
Thank you very much.
I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2074 and open up a work session on House Bill 2074.
Just read this.
Please.
Do I need to do an amendment? Mr. Chair?
No, it doesn't need an amendment.
Okay. I move House Bill 2074 to the floor with a due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Kenny Geyer moves House Bill 2074 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be assigned.
What's the word?
Referred to Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative Conger?
Excused.
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Kinninger?
Aye.
Representative Leiby?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Excused.
Vice Chair Dyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
And Chair Greenwood?
Aye. See how easy it is to get rid of no votes? Just, set it off somewhere. The motion
doesn't reflect on the bill, though.
That's good. And I will close the work session on House Bill 2074 and open an informational meeting on relating to congenital heart disease.
They're trying to prove something. I don't know what it is, but
please. We have two panels of three on this. You folks introduce yourself and go in whatever order you want.
All right. I think she's bringing your name.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here today. My name is Stephanie Thomas-Sweet, and I'm the Director of Government Relations for the American Heart Association. And yesterday actually was the first day of Critical Congenital Heart Defect Awareness Week. It's a National Awareness Week, and Governor Kitzhaber was gracious enough to issue an Oregon proclamation as well, which is why we're here today to kick that off. It concludes next Thursday on Valentine's Day, and we'll be back talking on the Senate side actually about this bill as well. We're here today to talk about critical congenital heart defects and to share our story. There's also a bill, House Bill 2693, that has been filed and it's working its way through the system. But so I just wanted to flag that for you. Congenital heart disease describes a variety of structural defects that are present at birth, and they can be mild to severe or life-threatening. And using national data, we currently don't track in Oregon, but using national data and looking at the statistics for Oregon births, about 300 to 350 babies are born in Oregon.
Tom, can I?
Yes.
I'm sorry. I forgot to announce, we are not going to be hearing House Bill 2637. So if people are here specifically because they're excited to hear about ticks, that bill will not be heard today. I'm sorry to interrupt, but I should have said that at the beginning.
Grace. Thank you, Chair Greenlick, and thank you for the opportunity to testify to all the members. There are roughly 300 to 350 babies born every year in Oregon that have a congenital heart defect, and about 75 to 85 have critical congenital heart defects, which means that the heart defect can be severe and life-threatening and can require intervention within the first few days of life. So in 2011, the U.S. Secretary for Health and Human Services endorsed the screening for CCHDs with the use of pulse oximetry for all infants in the U.S. pulse oximetry. We're going to talk a little bit more about it, and you'll hear from other members of the panels, but it's a non-invasive, painless test that measures the amount of oxygen in the blood, and it's a completely separate test from the newborn screening that uses the blood spots. So it does not use, it doesn't take a blood test. It just is literally a little pulse bulb that goes on and tests the oxygen, and you'll see a picture of it. It tests for 7 CCHD conditions, which I'm not going to try to pronounce because while I advocate for the Heart Association, I'm not the physician. I'll leave that for the others. It's a very cost-effective test. It's, costs range from about $5 to $10 per infant, depending on the equipment used. And many hospitals in Oregon are already screening for using pulse oximetry tests, and we're also going to hear a little bit more about that from some of the panels later on as well. So again, it's simple, cost-effective. Screening all newborns before they're discharged would identify CCHDs right away so that the babies can get treatment that they need. It would also, it can prevent the loss of life. It can prevent the severe and complicated medical conditions. It can also help save cost systems down the, costs down the road for complications that would arise for an undetected CCHD. The American Heart Association nationally has endorsed this as a national policy priority. We're working with colleagues across the country. There are several states working on this, and we are one of them, obviously. But this is a national priority for us. We strongly support the screening of all newborns for critical congenital heart defects, and we support these bills and urge your support as well. So thank you very much for giving us the opportunity to be here today, and I really look forward to turning it over to my colleagues to share their stories as well.
If you have questions along the way, feel free to ask them.
Chair Greenlick and committee members, my name is Joanne Rogovoy, and I'm the State Director of Program Services for the March of Dimes Greater Oregon Chapter, and I'm here today to give you the March of Dimes perspective on screening all newborns in Oregon for critical congenital heart defects. This year, the March of Dimes is celebrating its 75th anniversary, and the mission of the March of Dimes is to improve the health of newborns by preventing birth defects, preterm birth, and infant deaths. And it's also good to note that 2013 is the 50th anniversary of newborn screening in this country as well. One of our organization's proudest accomplishments is our contribution to newborn screening through research, education, and advocacy. March of Dimes grantees developed the first screening test for PKU, biotinidase deficiency, congenital adrenal hyperplasia, and the screening for hypothyroidism. And in the 1960s, Oregon was a pioneer in newborn screening. We were the first state, along with Massachusetts, to mandate screening for PKU. So this state has a long history. As part of our mission and our support of newborn screening, there are several conditions that must be met before we endorse a condition to be added to the screening panel. One is that it's a documented there's a documented medical benefit to the affected infant from early detection and there's treatment. Two is that there's a reliable screening test for the disorder. And three, that early detection can be made from a specific means. As such, March of Dimes supports the addition of critical congenital heart disease screening in Oregon newborns because it meets all three criteria. So we support House Bill 2693. It would allow for screening of newborns with CCHD via pulse oximetry. Stephanie mentioned that critical congenital heart disease is a subset of congenital heart disease. And pulse oximetry would pick up 7 of those 9 critical congenital heart diseases, and it would offer early screening, early treatment to affected infants before they leave the hospital, before they get into severe trouble, and before there's a life-threatening event that causes them to return to the hospital with symptoms that are much more dire than when they were released from the hospital. There are about 40,000 infants in the United States that are born with congenital heart disease, and about 4,800 of those have critical congenital heart disease. And nearly 300 infants are discharged from the hospital each year around the nation that have undetected critical congenital heart disease. Studies have shown that screening for critical congenital heart disease with pulse oximetry in the newborn period have a low false positive rate. Many studies have been done, and the false positive rate ranges from 0.17 to 0.14%. So it is a good test for this disorder. And the Secretary's Advisory Committee on Heritable Disorders in Newborns and Children, it's charged with advising the Secretary of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services in areas relevant to heritable conditions in children, particularly in the newborn screening period. This advisory committee recommended that CCHD be added to the uniform panel of screening, and the Secretary adopted that recommendation in 2011. Eight states now screen. They've enacted legislation that requires screening for CCHD. Connecticut, Indiana, New Hampshire, New Jersey, Maryland, Tennessee, West Virginia, and California. And nine other states have legislation pending that would also add CCHD to their newborn screening panel. March of Dimes urges Oregon to also be one of those states that adds critical congenital heart disease screening to their newborn screening panel. Thank you for the opportunity to
thank you
be here.
Good afternoon, Representative Greenlick and Representative Kenny Geyer and everyone else. I'm going to show a video.
Your name, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Lindsay Lair, and I'm from Grants Pass, and I'm just a parent. So I'm going to show a video that was made by Grants Pass High School, and it was made for, he was a sparrow, which meant the children of Grants Pass High School actually worked community hours to help raise money for him for his medical costs. So they went out and did the most, actually, community service hours. They did like 2,500 hours between all the kids in high school of community service to help raise money for him. So this is the video that the kids there made for him, and this was made a couple months after he was born.
Thank you. With Caleb's story, he was, as some of you may have heard his story before, he was born on his due date. He was born and deemed perfectly healthy. He had gotten a 9 out of 10 on the Apgar test, so they thought he was perfect. Throughout the day, my family had noticed, actually it was my mom had noticed, that he was breathing really fast. I had asked the doctors and the nurses that had come to check on us, to check him, and they would listen to his heart, and they heard a little heart murmur, but most babies are born with heart murmurs, so they said they'd check him the next day before we left. And they kind of gave me the new mom syndrome, like it wasn't anything. So that night I couldn't sleep, and it was about 2 a.m., and I asked a nurse if she could give me something to help me sleep. So she came in to give me a sleeping pill, and she was a new nurse, so I thought I'd ask her if she would take me as well. She did a pulse ox test on him, and she couldn't get a reading on either leg and on one arm, and barely got a reading on another arm. And at first she deemed it that the machine was malfunctioning, and asked if I wanted to take him into the NICU. And I thought, well, we had just filled out the paperwork for him to be released at 10 a.m. that morning, so let's do it. So I went with her, and she did another pulse ox test and found out that the machine was correct and he wasn't receiving oxygen from his neck down. But the good thing is because the valve that it was, it saved his brain. So they didn't know that because his heart was working. They said he was moments from dying. So had I taken that sleeping pill and gotten to sleep, he would have died. They did everything they could to keep him alive while they assembled a team. We were from Grants Pass. They assembled a team from Medford, and it took them 4 hours to get this team together to come get him. In the meantime, they discovered, when they did an x-ray of his chest, they discovered that he had a endocardioechofibroelastosis, and that's where his whole heart was in so much stress, it had swollen into his chest, and all the muscles had tore, and he had an infection in there. They brought him to Medford, and they did tests that they were able to send right up to Emmanuel Hospital, and then they flew him to Emmanuel Hospital. But his heart was, it was so hard for his heart to work that they told us over and over, he's not going to make it. In fact, they had us sign paperwork before transporting him to Portland, that we had to understand that they didn't think that he would make it because the cabin wasn't compressed and his heart was so damaged. And then after his second surgery, the head surgeon came in and said he'll probably live 3 to 6 months. So for that first year, he couldn't walk or crawl because anything was too much stress on his heart. He's got an older brother, so his brother couldn't play with him and couldn't be active around him because it would make him too wound up. We had to keep him really calm. So the reason why we're asking for this pulse ox test to be done is that time that it took for it to be discovered, it had done so much damage that his heart, the damage is irreversible to his heart. It could have cost him his life. He was on the heart transplant waiting list twice. He'll still be forever damaged from it. So that's why we're trying to get this going so that no other families have to go through this, so no other babies have to go through it. And it's not just saving their heart, it's also could be saving them mentally as well, since my son, they didn't even know if he had mental damage done as well. So that's why we're asking for this.
I think you have us in stunned silence. Any questions?
Go ahead. Just a comment. Thank you for coming to share your story. And I see it hasn't been easy. Actually, it wasn't easy for us either. It's a remarkable story.
Thank you.
Bless you.
What's holding up this bill? We don't have it today for...
It was dropped late.
Oh, okay.
We expect it'll be signed here.
Okay.
Shouldn't be a problem.
Don't set us up.
We'll probably get it. It's been first read, hasn't it?
I'm sorry?
The bill's been first read, hasn't it?
No, not yet.
I'm not sure. Okay. I expect... Do you know?
I think so.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to thank you, Lindsay, and I know that your husband is here, and the big brother I recognize from the film, and it looks like he's got his support team there with him, too.
Yeah.
And, you know, clearly this, you coming here is really fantastic, because clearly this bill will not help Caleb at this point, but you're helping so many other families not have to go through what you've gone through, and it seems so obvious. You made a great case for it. And thank you for taking the trouble to come down.
Thank you.
Or up, I guess.
Yeah, thank you very much. Okay. We have another panel to talk about this as well.
Physicians, yeah.
That's Carpenter, Lace, and... Can't read it. Okay.
Hello.
In the order.
All right. Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, my name is Heather Carpentier. I am a pediatrician at Oregon Health and Science University.
Can you pull the mic a little closer?
Oh, yes. Sorry. Heather Carpentier, pediatrician at Oregon Health and Science University. I'm representing myself as well as the Oregon Pediatric Society today. I'm here today because I have a particular interest in pulse oximetry screening to detect critical congenital heart disease in newborns. As you may know, congenital heart disease is the most common birth defect affecting nearly 400 annually in the state of Oregon. And nearly 100 of those are critical, and by definition, that means they require some sort of intervention early in life, sometimes within the first few days of life. It is estimated that 25% of newborns with critical congenital heart disease leave the hospital undiagnosed. Pulse oximetry screening is an effective, cheap, and non-invasive test that can diagnose critical heart defects earlier. Therefore, I am an advocate for universal pulse oximetry screening. Over the last year, I launched an educational outreach program to encourage pulse oximetry screening in Oregon and surrounding states. Through this process, I collected data regarding the current status of pulse oximetry screening and the barriers to implementing screening programs in hospitals. I surveyed all 50 nurseries in the state of Oregon. I received responses from 75% of them this past fall. At that time, nearly 60% of nurseries were performing universal pulse oximetry screening, and nearly 15% were planning to start screening. This month, I'm in the process of collecting follow-up data, and some of the preliminary data already shows that 75%, I have data for now 42 hospitals, so 84% of the hospitals in the state of Oregon. And preliminary data shows that 74% of nurseries are now doing universal pulse oximetry screening, with another 7% planning to screen, and more data is still coming to me. This rapid increase in universal pulse oximetry screening is very encouraging, especially considering the American Academy of Pediatrics just endorsed universal screening just over a year ago. Some of this rapid increase is directly related to my educational program this last year. I know of a few newborns that have been diagnosed in the last year in Oregon solely due to universal pulse oximetry screening. I have also cared for newborns that were diagnosed late and have seen the unfortunate complications they suffered due to their late diagnosis. I therefore support universal pulse oximetry screening, which is quickly becoming standard practice in our state. I do have some concerns that should be addressed by Oregon Health Authority. If this bill were to pass, I would like to see a system in place that encourages evidence-based screening, follow-up, and monitoring for quality assurance. I would also like to know if Oregon Health Authority has resources for smaller birthing centers, such as those nurseries that don't have access to echocardiography, the test that's required if an infant had a positive screen. Lastly, my research over the last year has shown that education is a powerful tool to ensure proper pulse oximetry screening. Does Oregon Health Authority have resources to educate additional staff, such as nurses or midwives, overseeing newborn care outside of a hospital setting? Thank you very much for your time. I'd be happy to answer questions today as well as in the future. I'd also be willing to share my knowledge as well as my data with Oregon Health Authority on pulse oximetry screening.
Thank you very much. Jim, nice to see you.
Thank you.
Representative Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Lace. I'm a pediatrician here in Salem. I represent the Oregon Pediatric Society and the Oregon Medical Association. I'm here to support the bill. We're actually not hearing a bill today, but supporting the concept of it and the evidence behind it. So I'm here to answer any questions. I've been here long enough in practice to see kids that have been picked up and kids that have not been picked up, kids who have died, kids who have suffered brain damage because we just missed it. And we're not set up. And the usual practice is to listen, check babies, and babies are in and out of the hospital sometimes less than 24 hours. So this would give us a heads up on kids that we don't even have time to really observe properly. So this is a good idea, and I think the time is right for it. We can add that into our panel of newborn hearing screenings. It's non-invasive, and it's relatively cheap.
Let me ask you and Dr. Carpenter. I assume this is similar to the pulse ox measurement.
I have one here, actually.
Yeah, we could do it. Does everybody know how that works? Everybody's been involved with healthcare, no?
Why don't you explain how that works?
So I brought one here with me. It's a I won't take it out of the package, then we can actually use it. But it's essentially a sticker, or some places we actually at OHSU we use a plastic one that's different to this, but then we use some sort of thing to stick it to the toe or the foot or the hand. Plug this part into a monitor, which is already in the hospital room, and it measures the oxygen level in the baby's blood. You can also do this portably. We actually use a portable machine at OHSU, so that way we don't have to take the baby outside of the room from the mother. That makes it available for people to do at home if this was to apply to nurse visits, for example, and for home births, for example. So it's just a vital sign. Like we do, this is a vital sign that we do in every other setting. Just up to this point, we haven't routinely done it on a newborn because for a while we weren't sure we knew what a normal oxygen level in a newborn should be, but now we do.
And the zero
is probably not the right number.
No, zero is definitely not.
The technology has come to the point where the pulse oximeters are relatively cheap. Initially they were very expensive, and now you can have a home O2 sat monitor if you wanted for $100, $200. The ones that are more professional grade, you're going to be looking at maybe $500, $600, $700, but they're not cost prohibitive. And these are disposable. You could recycle them if you had a system in place. And for newborns, you need the special probe that wraps around the foot. For an adult, if you're going in for surgery, you'll have it either on your earlobe for the anesthesiologist to monitor you, or they'll put it on a finger or something else so they can check. And it actually measures, it's a reflectance meter. And you're looking at the color changes in the hemoglobin molecule when oxygen's on there, not on there. And so what you're doing is actually saying, this is based on our understanding, if you're at 95% on the O2 sat monitor, your oxygen level's within the normal range. If you're less than that, then you need something more done to follow up on that. So it's simply a screening test, but we use it every day, and it works.
Yeah, many of us, I'm sure, have had that thing stuck on our finger and looked at. Is the price the disposable unit? Is that, I mean, because it seems to me it shouldn't cost anything to do.
Yeah, so at OHSU, that's why we use the reusable unit, because it's a lot more cost effective. And that was one thing I encouraged in my educational program was the use of reusable ones, because these disposable ones are more expensive. At OHSU, they cost about $15 a piece. Some places they say more around the $10 range. But if using the reusable one, it should only be a few dollars per baby. Screen.
And then there's nursing education that has to be built into the whole thing. This is get the nursing staff up to speed in terms of how you do this and make sure that it's reportable on the record.
I assume they must have to know how to do this for routine pediatric, newborn practice anyway.
They should, yes, and I think it gets done routinely. I mean, it gets done on babies that you have some question about, but right. It's not done on every baby, which we go beyond this. So it's very simple.
But they know how to do it.
Yes, yeah. Right. It's not complicated.
Like I said, it's a vital sign that we otherwise would do in every other setting. We do it in the clinic. We do it in the hospital and other settings.
I can speak to that a little bit.
Yep.
Hi.
Committee people. I'm Pat Sheens. I'm a neonatal nurse practitioner. I work for Legacy Health System in Portland and Vancouver. We have 5 hospitals, 5 nurseries, 2 NICUs. And just to talk about this, the process and rolling it out in a hospital after helping develop our program, nurses already know how to do pulse oximetry on babies. It was just a matter of taking those completely asymptomatic patients, babies, and screening and comparing. We're doing the American Academy of Pediatrics algorithm that they developed. We screen them on their right hand. That's the, as our mom was talking about, is the preductal site before there can be mixing of blood in the aorta. The aortic arch and the other two branches that come off. So we use that, and then we put the same probe on their foot and compare those numbers. And so it's very easy. The nurses have known how to do that all along. The program to roll it out was really simple. Our pediatric groups all were on board with it. Since we use the same probe on the hand and the foot, our probes are, we have a probe for recycling them, and it's somewhere between the $5 and $10 mark. We have screened for a year now and have had, we think, zero false positive occurrences. And we had one baby who would have gone home, would have come back in extremis when the heart function started to fail, who went home, went from one hospital to the Randall Children's Hospital, which is our new children's hospital, for heart surgery, went home breastfeeding, and doing well. So that was, we were really thrilled about that, and you can imagine how the staff felt saving a baby like that. It was really a big thing for all of us. So if I can answer any questions about the process, nursing-wise, hospital rollout-wise, I'd be happy to.
Yes,
thank you, Mr. Chair. What were you able to do for that baby that you talked about that enabled him or her to go home?
All the screening process is for an asymptomatic baby. So this baby was over a day of age, getting ready to go home. The nurses did pulse oximetry screening and were alarmed that it was abnormal. The babies, because our eyes aren't good enough to tell us that the baby's saturation was only in the 80s, not over 95 like it should have been, they, you know, rallied their friend and said, hey, come check this. I'm afraid it's you know, erroneous, just like we were talking about earlier. They actually have to fail three times. Mm-hmm. You do it every hour for 3 hours. Mm-hmm. But so this normal-appearing baby was found to fail mm-hmm. pulse oximetry, so then had echocardiography to look at the heart. Mm-hmm. And you can't always see everything, like an ultrasound, prenatal ultrasound, and then, of course, we couldn't even see it clinically by looking at the baby. But this baby had veins that were returning to the part of the heart, so these little blood vessels coming back from the lungs that would have been difficult to see. And that was an anomaly that could be corrected with heart surgery. And so then the baby was moved to have heart surgery. And had it right away.
Right away.
Right away. So, yeah. As opposed to going home and getting heart failure or their blood getting acidotic and those sorts of things. Then you're operating on a patient who's ill as opposed to this fairly well mm-hmm. baby who mm-hmm. tolerates the surgery better and all that stuff.
Are there other questions? Well, I think you all have piqued our interest. It's unusual to have a hearing before we have a bill, but I thought because of the week, this was a good thing to do this week to highlight what's going on. And when we have a bill, we'll have another public hearing, and maybe we do a little of this again.
And if you want us to bring an O2 sat monitor just to walk you through what it looks like, how it actually works, we can do that. It's very simple. So
That might not be a bad idea for those of us that haven't spent a lot of time with a pulmonologist.
I was just going to say we had one 2 days ago. We had the nurse anesthetologist, I can't remember if I said that right, who were doing it out here.
Outside.
And maybe some of you had it. I had it done to me.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good to see you all. I will close the informational meeting on screening for newborn congenital heart defects and open a public hearing for House Bill 2612 and... Would you like to introduce this?
Sure. Can I do it from here?
You can do it from anywhere you want.
I'll just be right here. Okay. Thank you, colleagues. House Bill 2612 provides that postpartum mother and certain persons may remove placenta from a healthcare facility in certain places. So this came to my attention because many people like to be able to take their placenta home with them. In fact, many people who have home births, actually almost all of them do keep it. Very few of them give it back to the midwife to be disposed of. But in hospital settings, many women have asked for the placenta to be taken home. Many feel it's their own body organ. Some bury it. Some actually, there's a thriving small business here in Oregon where they actually dry and pulverize and encapsulate it, and women eat it and believe, I haven't seen the evidence on it, but believe very strongly that it fights maternal depression and helps with blood regeneration of the blood, so prevent anemia. So many hospitals have tried to respond to their patients who want to take their placentas home and have come up with waivers or different systems to handle this, and we have since learned, it came to our attention, that it's actually appears to be illegal in statute because hospital facilities are not allowed to send any kind of human tissue home. So since this is already happening, and I think it's great that hospitals are responding to the requests of patients, this bill is basically, the gist of it is to make this practice legal. With certain sideboards. So I am hoping that we can call Patty O'Sullivan from the Hospital Association to as our first and maybe only testifier.
And we're waiting some amendments to this bill, is that right?
Correct.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Patty O'Sullivan, and I'm representing the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. And I'm really glad to be here today to testify on this bill. When I first looked at the bill, it was sort of a huh? And I really had that reaction. I've had a lot of children. I've never even seen a placenta, I don't think. But the more I looked into it and talked to our hospitals about it, the more that I realized the kind of the ins and outs of it. And culturally and in some religions, this is something that Representative Kenny Geyer talked about, that women like to take their placenta home and do various things with it. I also realized through talking with my hospitals that this is an occurrence that is currently happening. When you look at the statute, not this particular one in the bill, but the one above it and the wraparound statutes, are statutes about how to dispose of, for hospitals, how to dispose of hazardous waste, biological material, etc. And this falls under biological material. And what it says in biological material is you have to take it and burn it. And normally hospitals keep some biological material like the placenta, maybe a period of 5 to 7 days, it varies, because sometimes after birth, something during birth or the baby after birth, the obstetrician will want that placenta to be tested. And it might help diagnose some illnesses or other things. And that's why we keep it a period of time, not very long, and then it's disposed of. But hospitals have been giving it out because things change in our modern world. So if you look at the exemptions under this is what you have to do with biological material, they were kind of running on the second exemption. But if you really look at it, it's kind of unclear whether that applies or not. So when the bill came out, I just, like I said, I was kind of, huh? And then now, after really talking to a lot of people about this, more than I ever wanted to know about placenta and their activity and where they go, I realized that we actually do need this bill. So then I started saying, oh, so what do you think about it? And there's some things that we need to be sure that we're taking into account. One of them is that if the obstetrician recommends some more pathology and the placenta is sent to the lab, there's a fluid that is used to preserve that placenta that is then called hazardous waste. And it's something like 75% formaldehyde and 25% something methane or something that is then considered a hazardous waste. So once your placenta goes to the lab, it cannot be released to you because it becomes hazardous because of the material used to preserve it. So there's some little outlying things like that we have to assure that the rules would cover, that it would be very clear to the parents or the mom that they couldn't take it in that case. And today, in today's world, what happens is they sometimes then say, then I don't want it tested because I want to take it home. And that is their choice. You would not mandate that, you know, it has to go to the lab and be tested. So we just want to make sure we have all the information that we need to you know, be sure that everybody knows when it's acceptable to release and when it's not, and to whom. Because, again, in today's world, who is the mother? Is it the person that gave birth? Is it the person that donated the egg? Is it the person adopting the child? I don't know. I mean, I don't know who would want it. And maybe if they all want it, then what do we do? And we, Representative Kenny Geyer and I talked yesterday, and who's the dad? I mean, you could have three guys show up and want the placenta. We don't know. So we really have to, through rule, figure this out to make sure. Representative Clem, I'm not looking at you.
You're to the committee. I'm sorry.
Okay, go.
I'm good.
Oh, I thought you had a question.
No, no question.
Okay. So anyway, but these are all little things that need to be worked out in rule, and what type of a form that somebody would have to sign, where's the liability. And the most important thing is that we not release an infected placenta, i.e. mom has HIV, hep C, hep B, and so that the mom, but what we're trying to figure out now is what is a mom routinely tested for prenatal or postnatal, and would there be additional tests, and then at what expense, and who would pay for that? So that's a long way of saying that we support the bill with some amendments, and anticipate that most of these issues will be worked out in rule with some people who know much more about this than I do.
Are there any questions?
Either of our witnesses. Thank you. Does anybody else want to testify to this? Okay, we are waiting amendments. When we get the amendments, we'll bring it back for a work session. We've had a public hearing. And I close the public hearing on House Bill 2612. And Mr. Administrator, do we have any other business today? Okay, we're going to set a new record for us. We're getting out.
Less than an hour.
An hour early.
I think that's a record for the last three terms.